And welcome back to Coast with our guest, Michael Cremo. Michael, does the theory here of human devolution, does it coincide with the things that you found in forbidden archaeology?
Well, what I found in forbidden archaeology, I believe, just tells us we need a new explanation of human origins. I mean, there's just so much physical evidence that contradicts what we're now being told about human origins in antiquity, that it becomes necessary to start thinking about new ideas. So that's what forbidden archaeology does. It just tells us we've got all this evidence that humans existed millions and millions of years ago. It means we need a new explanation. But what I've proposed in human devolution is that before we even get involved in that, we have to take a closer look at what a human being really is. We should know what it is we're trying to explain. And many scientists are going to say, well, we're just a combination of ordinary matter. Mm-hmm. But
and we changed and evolved over the years.
Yes, materially. But I think if we look at all the evidence that comes to us from science, we're going to see that a human being is more than just a combination of matter. There's also a subtle mind element that has the ability to act on ordinary matter in some very unusual ways that some people call psychic powers or paranormal powers and things like that. So I think that has to be taken into account. And then beyond that, there's a conscious self that can exist beyond the body, beyond the mind in its own right. And there's a whole body of scientific evidence for that, too. So what this does is it kind of takes us out of the realm of the stones and bones, you know, that I talked about in forbidden archaeology and into other areas of forbidden knowledge. And there's been a lot of knowledge filtration going on in this area. But I think if we actually look at all the evidence and not just what we see in the current textbooks, we're going to see that a human being is a combination of matter, mind, and consciousness, and that this leads to another idea, namely that our whole cosmos is a multi-level cosmos divided into different levels, each dominated by one of these elements and inhabited by beings adapted to the conditions there. So we find ourselves now on the level of the cosmos dominated by ordinary matter. But beyond that, there's a level of the cosmos dominated by the subtle mind element and inhabited by beings adapted to the conditions there, who have been traditionally called angels, gods, goddesses, astral beings, extraterrestrials, or whatever.
Well, what really got you thinking this way? Because this is not hard evidence, like your first work.
Well, there actually is what I would call a body of hard evidence. There are two things that got me thinking about it. One is the ancient wisdom traditions, which all speak of these things, but there's also a body of scientific evidence that tends to support this idea that there is a subtle mind element and that there are beings that inhabit this realm of the subtle mind. I was mentioning in the first hour the work of Madame Curie, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist who was involved in studying mediums who had psychokinetic abilities. There's work going on like this even today. Dr. Robert John, who was the dean of the engineering department at Princeton University, started doing experiments with random number generators. And, you know, random number generators,
right.
You know, those are the machines that will generate as an output a series, random series of zeros and ones. And if you let the machines run by themselves, they generate 50% ones, 50% zeros. But Dr. John and his colleagues recruited students from Princeton University to sit in front of these machines, and simply by mental intention alone, they were able to cause the machines, for example, to generate more ones than zeros, or more zeros than ones, according to their mental intention. So to me, this is evidence for a subtle mind element that can act on ordinary matter in ways that we really can't explain by our current laws of physics. So if we're going to talk about human origins, I think we have to go beyond, you know, the DNA and the molecules and the atoms, and we have to talk about this subtle mind energy as well. And then beyond that, there's a conscious self that can exist beyond the mind, beyond matter. And there's evidence for that. It comes from medical reports of out-of-body experiences, for example. It comes from psychiatric reports of past life memories that indicate that a conscious self can go from one physical body to another physical body through a process of transmigration or reincarnation. So when you put it all together, you see that a human being is more than atoms and DNA. You know, that there is a subtle mind element there, and then beyond that, there's this element of consciousness, and from there, you have to explain, if you want to explain human origins, then you have to explain, well, where did all these things come from? Where did the matter come from? Where did the subtle mental energy come from? Where did this element of consciousness come from? And to me, that indicates that in our cosmos, there are reservoirs, there are regions of these different elements. And what I'm proposing in this book, Human Devolution, is that we begin our existence on the topmost level of pure consciousness or spirit, if you like that word, and that we, if we become attracted to these lower energies, then that conscious self descends into them and becomes covered by them, and that's where we find ourselves now. But as I said, there is a lot of hard evidence to support this in the forms of these experiments done by very prominent scientists showing the existence of a mind element and also showing the existence of an element of consciousness.
But it was always there, though, wasn't it?
Well, yes, people in the past have been very much more aware of these things than perhaps many of us today are. But this scientific evidence has been there. It still is there today, but it's been subjected to this knowledge filtering process by those who want to keep us focused on the world of ordinary matter. They like seeing us simply absorbed in the production and consumption of more and more material things. It generates a lot of material wealth. And if we were distracted from that process, there would be some pretty huge political, economic, and sociological effects. You know, if people were to put, say, more energy into developing the resource of consciousness than they put into the development of matter, yeah, that would have some tremendous economic implications. Just after 9/11, because people became a little bit frightened and they began just staying home and not going out and purchasing things,
right,
or flying on airplanes,
things shut down.
They just wanted to sit with their friends and their relatives and just talk about, well, what is this world coming to? What is the purpose of life? What's going on here? And because they did that, because they stopped this production and consumption a little bit, the economy went down worldwide a few percentage points, and that caused political shockwaves all over the world. You know, we had to see our president go on television and say, travel, fly, go to shopping centers,
yeah,
purchase.
Yeah.
So I think that shows why some forces in this world want to keep us focused simply on the idea that we're purely material beings. Because if we are purely material beings, then we're going to stay absorbed in this process of material production and consumption.
How did these ancients,
which is benefiting a lot of people?
Of course. How did these ancients know this, and we still have a heck of a time trying to figure it out?
Well, I think everybody has some sense of these things, because even in a country like the United States of America, 90% of the people have some experience of these things. There have been Gallup surveys done. 60% of the people believe in UFOs, and many of them claim to have had UFO experiences. 40 to 50% of the American people claim to have had communications with the dead or other types of psychic or paranormal experiences.
Sure. Well, all you got to do is turn on your television and look at what the hot shows are.
Sure. So I think, the thing is that most people in the world have never stopped accepting these things, but it's as if we've been hijacked. Say if you may have a lot of people on a 747, you may have 400 or 500 people, but it just takes a few hijackers to, control the plane. And, so I think that's the situation we're in this world today, that most people in their hearts and in their lives accept the kind of things that I'm talking about. But we've got very influential groups of people, scientists, politicians, industrialists, and others, who have a different idea. They've more or less hijacked the human civilization, you could say, and they've turned it in a certain direction. We may have been wanting to fly, and just like the people when they get on the airplane, they think they're going to go somewhere. They've paid to go in a certain direction, but the hijackers take them in another direction, and there's not too much they can do about it unless they find a way to take the plane back under control, which can be pretty difficult. So I think that's the situation we're in today. Most people have never stopped believing in these things, but the people who are now in charge of the airplane, you could say, have a different idea, and they're trying to take us in another direction. I think we've got to somehow or other get back in control of our lives and put ourselves in the right direction.
The subtitle of this book, Human Devolution, says a Vedic alternative to Darwin's theory. What does that mean?
Well, I say that because my work is inspired by my studies in these ancient Sanskrit writings. But at the same time, I realize that they're part of a larger spiritual family of alternatives to Darwinism. In other words, I'm not claiming to have some exclusive monopoly on the truth. I recognize that the world's great spiritual traditions, whether we're talking about Christianity or Islam or Judaism or Buddhism or Native American traditions, they all pretty much say the same thing. If you look deeply enough, they all say humans have been around since the very beginning of the history of life on Earth. They all say that this is not our real home, that we've come from some higher level of reality. They all say there's life scattered throughout the universe. They all say that we live in a multi-level cosmos. Now, they may have different terminologies, but if you really look closely at them, you'll see that they have a lot in common. So when I say, I'm offering a Vedic alternative, I'm just being honest that, well, among all the traditions that are out there, this is the one I found.
Right.
That works for me.
Did they get it during that period of time? I mean, were they?
Well, I think they did, because if you look at the descriptions of what the world was like, because these descriptions of these ancient civilizations at these times when they understood, not just the ordinary people, but the people in the government, the people who were actually running the society, but they understood that we are part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of beings, that prosperity on Earth depends on our proper relationships with beings at other levels of this cosmic hierarchy. Things apparently were going a lot better than they are today. So I guess what I'm trying to accomplish in my work, and I'm not alone in this, I look at myself as a one member of a, 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 of a large group of researchers that are in their different ways trying to move things in a certain direction. For example, 2 years ago I spoke at the Crop Circle Symposium in Glastonbury, England, and I had the good fortune to meet Dr. John Mack, who was the Harvard psychiatrist. Who,
God rest his soul, huh?
Yeah, I mean, who, and so he came up to me after my talk, and he said he was appreciating a lot of things that I was saying, and I was also appreciating his work because I cite his work extensively in Human Devolution. For those of your listeners who don't know, he was the Harvard psychiatrist who became interested in these UFO alien abduction accounts, and he investigated these people very carefully, and he found that they're not psychotic, they're not neurotic, they are same people who are reporting experiences in a truthful way, and they're displaying the symptoms of people who have undergone some traumatic experience.
Put his career on the line, Michael. He did.
Yes, he did. And his colleagues at Harvard tried to get his tenure revoked.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they wanted to get him removed from his position. Now, he successfully fought that.
And then he gets killed.
Huh?
And then he gets killed, hit by a car.
That's right. That happened in England last year.
Yeah.
And I was very sorry to hear about that because we had agreed to stay in touch with each other and try to coordinate our activities a little bit. So I think that was very unfortunate. But I guess the point I was making is I don't see myself as a kind of lone crusader in what I'm doing. I see myself as part of a group of researchers representing a lot of people on this planet who would like to see things move in a little bit different direction than they're moving now.
Michael, the work that you've done in terms of the past civilizations on this planet, did you ever come across anything that would lead you to believe that we were visited, seeded, jump-started by aliens or extraterrestrials?
Yes, but I think it's a little more complicated picture than that, because the way I look at it, we're not just dealing with extraterrestrials in the sense of beings that live on other planets on our level of reality. Because I think there are other dimensions of reality. I was mentioning this dimension of the subtle mind element, which according to many traditions and a lot of scientific evidence, is full of astral beings, gods, goddesses, things like that. Even when you look at the extraterrestrial phenomenon, you've got two sets of researchers. One is the nuts and bolts type of researcher, which wants to see extraterrestrials as sort of material beings like ourselves who have just developed a little bit more advanced technology and are making machines made of ordinary matter and operating according to physical laws and things like that, but coming from other planets or other solar systems. But a lot of the researchers these days, when they look at this UFO phenomenon, the alien phenomenon, people like John Mack, for example, see that it starts to shade into the paranormal.
Hold that thought, Michael. We'll be right back. I want you to finish that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Michael, you were just getting into something fascinating about the UFOs and whether we had been seated or not. You were also talking about John Mack again, so I'll let you pick up that story.
Well, yes, we have been seated, I believe, but not necessarily in the way that some people would think, that that there are other intelligent life forms similar to us materially that exist on some other planet on our particular level of reality, sort of like some super scientist. Like our Earth scientists, but a little more advanced, who have come and maybe just put some DNA down here. I think there's more to it involved than that. And this gets back to the idea that we're not just DNA and molecules, that we're, that's part of what we are, but you've also got this mind element and this element of consciousness. So I think we're talking not so much about just extraterrestrial beings in the simplistic way of speaking about them, but what I would call extra-dimensional beings who are responsible for seating us here. And because I think what's really important, say, about Dr. John Mack's work is that that's the conclusion that he came to as well, that we live in a multi-level cosmos.
Right.
And he said that in his last book, that, and I think anybody who really looks at all the evidence is going to come to that conclusion as well, that we're not just material beings existing in a material cosmos, that we're very complex beings with elements of matter, mind, and consciousness put together in a very complex way that couldn't just happen by chance. I think when scientists actually look at even the complexity of the materialistic part of the human being, they find it's very difficult to explain just in terms of the atoms combining by chance in the Earth's early ocean to form some first living thing or something like that. I think anybody who really looks at this matter carefully is going to see that there's some intelligence involved. And I don't think it's the kind of intelligence that would be manifested simply by some other type of material being on our level. I think there are more intelligent beings that exist on higher levels of reality that are responsible for seeding us here.
Could we be talking also about parallel universes and things like that?
Well, that's pretty interesting because the ancient Sanskrit writings of India speak of millions of universes, not just one. And this is an idea that's come up in only recently in modern science as a way to get around the fact that the universe, the one universe that we live in, appears to have been intelligently designed for life to exist in it. And when cosmologists and astrophysicists look at the universe, they find that there are some constants of nature, there are some physical laws, there are some ratios of natural forces that are so finely tuned that if they were even slightly different, there wouldn't be life in our universe.
True.
For
True.
Example, the ratio of the mass of a proton to the mass of an electron in an atom is very, very finely tuned. And if it were even slightly different, then we wouldn't have stable atoms, there wouldn't be stable molecules, there wouldn't be stars and planets or any of the living things that we observe. And it's not that just there's just one of these ratios that's like that. There are many of them. Sir Martin Rees, the Royal Astronomer of England, wrote a very interesting book, Six Numbers, where he looked at six of these ratios of different natural forces. And if any of them were slightly different, we just wouldn't have a universe fit for life. So to get around that, what some astronomers have done is proposed, well, there are millions of universes, and where these forces are adjusted in different ways randomly, and we just happen to have won the lottery. Of course, that's a very speculative idea. Nobody's ever seen one of these other universes, and to prove that idea, you'd have to see them and show that there's not life in them. But according to the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, there are millions of other universes, and there's life in all of them. It's not that we've won the lottery. All of the universes are designed for life to exist in them.
What do you think of Zechariah Sitchin's work with those Sumerian texts?
I think if people read my books or they listen to what I have to say, see, normally I don't talk so much about other researchers and things like that. But if somebody asks me a question, then I'll reply to it. As As far as I know, like you say, he's approaching things from the perspective of the ancient Sumerian writings, and I'm kind of taking things from the ancient Sanskrit writings. Maybe other researchers are looking at the Egyptian writings, and others looking at the Mayan calendar and writings and things like that. So I think when I look at all of these, whether it's the Sumerian or the Vedic or the Egyptian or the South American or whatever, you're going to find some differences, but you're also going to find some commonalities. So the things that I would have in common with Sitchin's work, as far as I can tell, is yes, there is life on other planets. We have been visited by extraterrestrials, and I would say extra dimensionals in the way I would say it. As far as the ideas that I understand he has about the antiquity of the human race, I think his idea, if I understand it properly, is that evolution went on pretty much as the Darwinist scientists today say it went on, up to the point of Homo erectus, or one of the ape men that existed around 300,000 or 400,000 years ago. Right. And then at that time,
it was altered.
There was some alteration, and that's when we get the first anatomically modern human beings. Now, the research that I did in forbidden archaeology leads me to have a different idea, namely that anatomically modern humans existed far longer ago than 400,000 years ago.
And from the get-go, in terms of what they were, right? I mean, they were human beings instantly?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. You know, for example, in Italy, you can find at Castagnetolo discoveries of anatomically modern human skeletons and layers of rock about 4 million years old. Discoveries like this were also made in a place called Savona in Italy. And one of my readers, he wrote to me and asked if there were anything he could do. So I said, well, maybe you can track down those Savona bones. So he actually tracked them down. They're in a museum in Rome now, I think. And he sent me a photograph of these bones, which come from layers of rock about 4 million years old from this other place. And then you've got discovery, well, in America, there was, in the year 1862, a scientific journal called The Geologist, you know, published a report that an anatomically modern human skeleton had been found 90 feet below the surface of the ground in Macoupin County, Illinois. And we got in touch with geologists of the state of Illinois, and we asked them, well, how old are the layers of rock at that level, at that particular place? And they told us, well, that formation is about 300 million years old, which is from before the time of the dinosaurs.
And there's no way that skull could get down there, or, you know, some riverbed would take it downstream and down into a crevice somewhere. That couldn't happen.
Well, not in that particular case. Such things can happen, because, you know, it depends on the geological situation.
Sure.
Now, according to the report, in that particular place, there was a thick layer of slate rock that extended for just huge areas in all directions, completely sealing the skeleton off from the surface. So, in that case, and that layer of rock was unbroken. So perhaps, you know, if you could have shown, well, yes, that there was some old river channel or crevice or something that had broken the layer of rock through which a skeleton could have come down from some higher level. But according to the report published in this scientific journal, that wasn't the case here. The skeleton was completely sealed off from the surface by a thick layer of slate rock extending for hundreds of yards in all directions.
It's almost like these spheres you were talking about in the first hour.
Yeah. Now, if there were just a couple of cases like this, I mean, maybe it wouldn't be so significant, but there are hundreds of them, and I'm learning about more of them every day. I mentioned in one of the, you know, previous hour, you know, a case that was just reported to me by one of your listeners. So in terms of Sitchin's work, there are some things I would agree with him about. Yes, there are extraterrestrials. Yes, the Earth has been visited, and But as far as the antiquity of the human race, I'd put it further back in time than he does.
There are also some who believe that the beings on this planet, as you say, just seem to have been here. But if that's the case, Michael, if they were just humans from the get-go, did they still evolve on this planet, or are you saying that they were plopped down here?
Well, I would say they were put here, and they were given suitable vehicles to carry out their
mission, purposes. Their mission, whatever.
Because, you know, just say, what I'm proposing is we really belong on some other level of the cosmos, the level of pure consciousness or spirit. That's where we belong. If we drift down from there, you know, if we become attracted to the lower energies, then we kind of enter into them. We become covered by them, and the coverings take the form of different kinds of bodies. Just like, you know, if we want to go into some other element, for example, if I want to go into the water, you know, for more than a minute or so that I can hold my breath, I've got to have a suitable vehicle. You know, I've got to have a submarine or a diving suit or something. If I want to exist in the air, you know, if I want to fly in the air, I have to have a suitable vehicle. So when we come down to this level of reality, we need a suitable vehicle. And this human form is a vehicle for existing on this level of reality. Now, there are other forms that can also exist on this level of reality. We see there are so many forms of bodies of plants and animals and things like that. And I believe they also have conscious selves in them. But according to, you could say, the particular desire of the conscious self, it'll get a certain type of vehicle. So, and then by, I think there is a kind of evolution that goes on, not the kind that the Darwinists talk about, but there's an evolution of consciousness whereby when a conscious self becomes more aware, it gets a better vehicle, the best type of vehicle on this level being the human vehicle, you know, the human body. So I think there is a kind of evolution that of consciousness that goes on whereby a conscious self can move up through, you know, different forms of bodies till it gets to the human form. So there is a kind of evolution that goes on, but the different vehicles are there, you know, just like there's so many kinds of cars, you know, different prices, different models. You can get one kind of car or another kind of car, and in the course of a person's life, he may evolve through different types of cars. You may buy a used car when you're very young, and as your income increases, maybe you evolve up through different types of cars. You're still the same person, but you and all the cars are always there, but according to your income,
your likes and dislikes.
Yeah.
You have a complete chapter devoted to apparitions, angels, and aliens, and I find that to be fascinating in a book about human evolution and devolution. Why that chapter?
Well, because what I'm proposing is that we live in a multi-level cosmos, and with each level of the cosmos being inhabited by different types of beings. So some people are going to ask, well, where's this evidence for different types of beings existing on, you know, different levels of the cosmos? And I believe there is evidence for that. One category of such evidence comes from communications from humans that once exist on this level, but that have gone to some other level of the cosmos. And that means these communications with the dead, you know, that sometimes people experience. Then there are apparitions of departed humans. This also happens. There are also cases of possession of living humans by spirits of humans that have departed from this level and who have gone to some other level. A very interesting case was reported by William James, who was the father of modern psychology. And in his textbook, printed early in the 20th century, called Principles of Psychology. He describes a very interesting case of spirit possession that he considered to be a genuine case. It was called the Watseka Wonder. Watseka is a little town in Illinois, and there was a girl there named Lorancy Venom. And she lived a normal life until one day she went into a trance state, and she reported being possessed by the spirit of another girl who had died some years before. Her name was Mary Roth. And it caused some very interesting events to take place. She began to feel like a stranger in her own family. And when she was introduced to members of the Roth family, who she'd never met before, she immediately recognized them. She immediately identified with them. And finally, the parents of both families agreed that she should go and live with the Roth family. And when she did that, she manifested the personality of the Roth's departed daughter, Mary. She displayed knowledge of all the family's detailed intimate affairs going back many years, things that would have only been known to Mary Roth, the girl who had died a few years before. And this went on for several months until later the girl went into another sort of trance state. And she informed, she was informed, you know, by the spirit who had been possessing her that this spirit, Mary Roth, was going to go back, you know, to the level of reality where she was, you know, she had come from. And so for some time, both personalities were manifest, but finally, you know, the personality of Mary Roth left. And then this girl, she felt like a stranger in the Roth house. She immediately felt homesick for her own family, and then, you know, both families agreed she should go back. So what I found significant about this case is, first of all, it's reported by a really famous scientist, a very famous psychologist, William James, and a textbook of psychology. And, of course, these things are still being reported to this present day, but this is a very good case. Other categories of evidence would include apparitions of superhuman beings. Things like this often happen. You have angel apparitions, apparitions of extraterrestrial beings, apparitions of the Virgin Mary in some countries, and things like that. You also have cases of possession of humans on this level by these superhuman beings, which can be of a divine or sometimes a demoniac nature, as in the case of that movie, The Exorcist.
All right, let's talk a little bit about that when we come back, Michael. And also, we'll open up the phone lines. It's your turn to talk with Michael Cremo on Coast to Coast AM.